OTB Sports Golf Weekly with Now TV. Stream live football action with a Now TV Sky Sports Pass. Your sport on your terms.
Have you seen anything like that?
I'm a very confident front runner. I've caddied for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
Well, all hail the chief. Bryson DeChambeau, we genuflect before you. Fionn Davenport, good afternoon.
Hey, Joe.
Nathan Murphy, hello to you.
How are you?
Peter Laurie, good afternoon.
Hiya, Joe. How are you? Now,
before I go any further, I just have to say I wouldn't be here without my sponsors. I want to thank them. Now TV. I couldn't have done without you guys. Now TV.
I literally could not have watched the golf without you guys. So you were very important to this.
Now TV, we couldn't have watched the golf without you. We couldn't have won the US Open together, Now TV, where you can also stream live football action with a Sky Sports Pass. You can watch sport on your terms. Sorry, Steve Sands, what was the question? Oh, dear. That was a grim moment. I mean, I've never seen, ever, a major winner, Nathan Murphy, take that first schmaltzy question and turn it into a, I want to thank my sponsors.
Seems it's a Bryson thing, though, because I saw people teeing it up in advance of, I wonder, will he thank the sponsors before he thanks anybody else? So clearly he has a bit of previous with this. And then following it up in the press conference with a, hold on a couple of minutes there before we start this, while I bring in all the various different drinks brands I want right plonked down in front of me. And yeah, he doesn't help himself, does he? I feel like I want to defend him, but geez, he's tough to like.
Quick poll on Sunday as the round was unfolding, I found myself rooting for him. I mean, I was rooting for the story. I thought this is going to be really interesting for golf. I want DeChambeau to be at Augusta as a major champion. Quick, yay or nay. Fionn, were you rooting for DeChambeau? Who are you up for on the Sunday?
No, I was up for Matthew Wolf, but as soon as it became clear that DeChambeau was just by far and away, head and shoulders, the best guy out there, you know, it's hard to... Yeah, I wasn't rooting for him, but I applaud everything he did.
Peter?
Except for, you know, on the golf course, that is, everything else.
Yeah, I'm on the same boat. I possibly would have liked it to be in a bit closer, a little bit more interesting. But yeah, you know, he set out to do what he did, and fair play to him, he did it.
Nathan?
I was on Team Bryson. He was by far the most interesting possible winner on Sunday. And pardon me, as always, and it's not just the Bryson thing, it's whoever's leading a golf tournament, the potential of a collapse, I wouldn't have minded that either. Sure. I either wanted them to win it or have a humiliating, life-changing, disastrous final four holes. One or the other.
So, ever the broadcaster, you, Nathan. Yeah. Ever the broadcaster.
Let's get into this. Peter Laurie, you said this was basically impossible. You, like, I mean, there is so much egg on your face now, I can't even see it.
Wow. I just love to be thrown under the bus. But well,
yeah. You did. You said this would not work.
That bus rolling over me. But let me also bring in the likes of many, many other commentators and many, many other people who play the game.
That's pathetic.
Everybody.
Nobody saw this. Nobody said to me that this guy could swing the club at that speed and be, guess what, actually accurate. With what he was doing. Nobody saw how good an iron player he was, even out of his gouging of his out of the rough. And his short game has improved tremendously. Mm. His putting he's head and shoulders above the rest in putting, never mind the rest of it. And attitude on the golf course, he never, ever got down on himself once. He literally said every bad shot that he hit was, you know, geez, I hit that, or that was a really good shot. He had himself like a mind melt into everything was perfect. He was perfect. And if it didn't work out well, it wasn't his fault.
Mm. Well, he was certainly putting very well, even post-lockdown and a little bit before that on the PGA Tour. So I wasn't shocked at that. But the irons were quite inconsistent in the build-up to this tournament at times. He had sorted all that out. And then it was his ability to hit out of the rough that seemed to shock people as well. You know, Rory McIlroy made that point. Like, McIlroy was talking and he was saying that, you know, he'd watched him on the PGA Tour and he thought, well, okay, I can see how this works in benign conditions. But he said when he gets to a proper golf course, and this is a proper golf course, he's going to have to rein it in. That's what seemed to shock everyone, Nathan, is the extent to which he didn't have to rein it in.
Yeah, and I don't like a lot of the sort of commentary that's come out from other golfers since then, as if he's found some sort of cheat mode to golf. Yeah. He hasn't. Like, the one side I think that maybe hasn't been commented on a lot is maybe the mental side of him teeing himself up for this challenge. Like, how easy was it for him walking down every fairway, finding himself in the rough, when he'd said all week, this is what's going to happen? So he's under no pressure to hit fairways. So if you take the third of the field that are short hitters, you know the pressure that's on them. If they want to win this tournament, they've got to hit practically every fairway, which the way the course was set up was impossible. Even if you were driving well, you were struggling to land the ball on the fairway. Yeah. And also then, compared to McIlroy, Thomas, who are trying to hit fairways, but a long, long way down, like, they're a little bit disappointed if they're not getting the rub of the green, whereas he didn't care less. So as you say, his attitude on the course was, no matter what this course throws at me, I'm ready for it because I've prepared myself and I am taking it on the chin that I'm going to bomb it as far as I can. As I teed up on the Wednesday, I'm told the world I'm going to do this, so therefore nothing ain't going to get me down. And he played like that. So I think there's some of what's been said is a bit of an overreaction. Like, he also played very good golf. Like, just everything's focused on the distance.
Yeah,
his iron play, and I know yourself and Ronan touched on this last week, it means the iron play was negated, the advantage other players would have, because everybody found themselves in the rough so often. But also, he put it brilliantly.
He was helped dramatically by them cutting the rough on Tuesday, Wednesday. I think they topped the rough Tuesday and Wednesday, which is very surprising when they set up the golf course. And I know we all heard on the commentary that winged foot members were distraught at how the golf course was going to play on the Thursday, and they were right. It literally played too easy on the Thursday for a US Open. But I think, you know, I think you're right, Nathan. The way he his mental attitude was, you know, I'm going to miss fairways, but that's okay. And that worked for him.
He was so zen. I mean, you did think of the meltdown he had when he had that 10 not so long ago. There was one moment on Sunday where he was leaving the green and he was walking quite fast and he very dramatically slowed himself down. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah.
You did, Fiona.
I noticed that. It was actually quite stark, wasn't it?
Yeah, like, he almost came to a standstill and, like, reset and then walked, like, slow motion off the green. Yeah.
That was exactly it. And it's I had the exact same thought, where he was kind of rushing off, stopped and went, no, back into that slow rhythm. And, yeah, I thought that was actually one of the more remarkable insights of all of Sunday for me, was that exact moment where you got to see what Bryson was doing to keep himself in the moment. Now, having said all of that, Jesus, he's an awful whiner, though. Holy moly. And with no fans, and you can hear, it's a constant commentary with himself. Now, listeners are going to go, hey, you don't mind it when Jordan Spieth does it. And it's true. I don't mind it when Jordan Spieth does it. Also, Jordan Spieth's slow play doesn't bother me that much. Bryson plays really, really slowly, and that's fine. He's not alone. He's certainly not the slowest. And my God, he never stops. He's constantly talking, which I'm guessing, like many others, and Peter, you can tell me if I'm wrong here, but this is his way of just working out all his things. But I can't imagine it was easy for Matt Wolf, because Matt Wolf is the quicker player. So he had to deal with Bryson's kind of slower approach to the game. And I wonder if that wasn't one of the many factors that threw Matt Wolf off and caused him to kind of implode on the Sunday.
It just goes to show you where the US GA is and really the RNA and how slow they are in doing anything about anything in relation to golf. They harp on religiously about slow play. There's a referee with each group. Like, what is going on? What's that referee doing on Sunday? Watching.
It's Sunday of the US Open, Peter.
Yeah,
I don't care. Unbelievably tough.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that.
It's ridiculously slow.
Yeah.
You have to make an allowance for that day, though.
You have to, I agree.
Yeah, you are you can make an allowance, Joe. I would agree with you. But how much of an allowance? If the standard time is what, 4 hours, 20 minutes to play around, to play around in two balls.
Yeah.
Like, how much of an allowance do you give?
I think free reign, unfortunately, when they're the last group, absolute free reign. But I, like, don't get me wrong, the last hour of this thing was a snooze fest.
Mm. Yeah, but like, we had a conversation with Ronan Flood last week, right? And the last round with Tiger in, what was it, a WGC event. And they were put on the clock.
Yeah.
You know? And so they can do it then, and they can't do it at a US Open.
That's fair.
Is it worth kind of something that Paul McGinley said to you, Joe, when you were talking him during the week on Off the Ball, is that, is a reminder that is there another sport where the players, where the individual players have as much power as golf? Certainly more than maybe. I know players have relative to, but the players are enormously powerful. And I mean, I know we're going to get into this about changes made by the USGA or the RNA, but they are slow to change because they are coming up against a really powerful force in the players who will resist changes they don't like to the point where they can really upset the apple cart. So I wonder if the slow play issue isn't part of that, that if all of a sudden you were to impose the kind of penalties that they keep saying they're going to impose, and they often do on lesser known players who are way down the rankings, if they were to impose it on, say, the last two balls on the Sunday of a US Open, that there would be uproar, that it would actually be counterintuitive and it would come to hurt them. The USGA, that is.
Mm. Oh, people would say the USGA had made a mess of everything again. Yeah. Like, it's akin to a referee not wanting to send someone off in the cup final in the first minute. Yeah. You're accused of ruining the game. And it'd be an asterisk after the event if a shot was taken off, you know, a player and the other one. Mm. Just to, like, yeah, like, I think people are pretty au fait with just how good he was. But, like, I was saying to Paul McGinley the other night, the stat which jumped out at me, what is, like, Johnny Miller's 63 at Oakmont is about the most famous round there is. You know, certainly in US Open history, it's always quoted. So DeChambeau won by 7.9 shots on average over the field on the Sunday. He was 7.9 shots better in his final round. 7.9 shots better.
Yeah.
And that's the largest margin since Johnny Miller at Oakmont 50 years ago. Like, that's how good he was. And Nathan, you know, for getting on to the equipment debate, I was really curious to see how, you know, mainstream non-watchers of golf would interpret this. I don't know about you. I got a load of tweets again about DeChambeau and his size and how he's bulked up and the elephant in the room and all this kind of stuff has come up again. And he was seventh in distance. You know, DJ at 333, Rory is sixth at 328, and then you have DeChambeau averaging 325, whereas I think there is a perception out there now that he was hitting it further than everyone, and that is the only reason he won.
Yeah, and to throw that across, like, that statistic, Peter, is the one that now people will use against, say, McIlroy is the most obvious example, who's done quite a few interviews since, and maybe questioned the distance that they are allowed to hit it and the advantage that Bryson now has. Would you read anything into those distance stats? Like, was Bryson on certain holes holding back that somehow skews the stats somehow?
Yeah, well, what I would say about the stats is, and this is coming from the European Tour rather than the US Tour, so I don't know how they're correlated in the US, but on the European Tour, there's only two holes that they do stats on. They do two holes that are pretty equidistant from each other going up and down the golf course. So the wind direction is similar, but I could hit 3 wood off that hole and it would count as 280, but another guy would hit driver and it would count as 300. So therefore his stats on that week would be much better than mine, even though we didn't hit the same club off the tee. So,
well, I checked, they measured all the drives.
They measure all the drives?
Yeah, it wasn't just two. Now, admittedly, right, so you might have hit 3 wood on a certain hole, but they measured them all each day. But, like, I remember watching him and being surprised when he hit a driver and found the fairway. Like, quite often it wasn't the 320 to 330 range. It wasn't like he was hitting 360.
Mm. No, and Matthew Wolff was outside him quite a few times, hitting kind of that low ball flight that ran quite a long way past Bryson's shots.
The I don't, again, how quickly do you want to get into the bigger, greater debate about what it all means for golf, where we do does feel we should stand back and go, like, again, on a pretty much the toughest golf course they're going to play this year or over the next couple of years, he didn't have a single round over par.
Yeah, he
did not make a mistake. And again, yes, there are questions about the bulking up and all of that. But here is somebody who made a decision, a risky enough decision, that when he started doing this in terms of injuries and everything else, you know, he does his work with Mark Brody, does this work with all these statistics as to what the benefits may be. But he's got to go and do it. He's still got to go and do it. And all the effects and changes to his swing, to his putting stroke, like, that's not easy. Here's a player who works his ass off. He hasn't just put on 3 stone and overnight it's all just clicked into gear because he's entering the World Long Drive Championship. He's clearly working harder than 99% of players out there to get this done. So he deserves credit for that as well. This hasn't come easy. And like, it's good. It can work in pretty much any course is the one thing we've now seen. Like, people are talking about Augusta. Yeah. Like, if this is the toughest course, it's going to work there. And all right, maybe in somewhere like Harbortown, you may struggle at times where you do need to dial it back. But also, he's not the only one. And that is the bigger debate of, like, everything needs to go right for Colin Morikawa or for Webb Simpson to win a tournament. Yeah. Whereas, like, for Gary Woodland, for Brooks Koepka, for any of these guys, McIlroy included, you have a good week in the greens and you're probably going to win the tournament. Whoever is the best week in the greens now, by and large, is going to win the tournament.
And he was the best in the greens and he was the best to get, you know, the amount of escape shots, the amount of up and downs the guy had was extraordinary. And like Rory's saying, he's amazed at the way he did it. And I get his point because he's talking about amazed at how much rough he found. But like, Rory was beaten by 10 shots. Rory took 12 more putts. You know, like, if you're, I know strokes gained is more accurate, but it's an example of what we're talking about here. I mean, Bryson didn't four putt the first on the Sunday. Like, he won by just being rock, rock solid.
I mean, I know every single golf writer and podcast has done this since Sunday, but kind of drilling down into some of the details. Yes, Nathan's right. He played very, very well over the four rounds, but he was comprehensively beaten on the two easiest days. So on the Thursday and the Saturday, where the course setup was relatively easier compared to the other 2 days, Bryson didn't put in, like, the really great rounds. Like, he wasn't that far off. Like, he shot a 69 and then came in with a 70 the next day. But it's all the other players just couldn't keep up with the course setup on the two tough days, and Bryson could. And obviously threw in this remarkable round on the Sunday. So that was number one. Number two is, like, people are going on, oh, it's about, you know, hitting fairways. Well, DeChambeau hit the fewest fairways. He was, like, compared to, say, okay, so since 1981, no US Open winner has hit fewer than 27 fairways, okay? But Bryson DeChambeau, who was 26th for the field that week, he's only second in terms of most fairways hit by a US Open winner to Webb Simpson. So relative to the rest of the field, he hit more fairways, even though he hit very, very few. So it's not about that. But it comes down to the strength out of fairways, because and it's not the distance, because if he was seventh in distance, it's the strength that he has in that body to gouge a ball out with a short iron that the others just didn't have.
Maybe we've been looking at it wrong. Maybe actually a US Open course suits him more than Augusta when there's only, you know, minimal rough, you know, so like what's Brendan Todd meant to do with a 5 iron?
Exactly. And so the fact is that all of a sudden, when faced with the difficult challenge of hitting a ball out or whatever it is, 5 inch rough, most of the other players, and sadly enough, it includes your McIlroys, it includes your Justin Thomases, it includes all the other guys, they don't have the muscle that DeChambeau has. He is getting the ball out. Mm. And on those 2 days when the course is set up easier, DeChambeau doesn't have that advantage. So other players are coming in and in most cases are actually shooting good enough scores or better.
Like, is it that? Maybe it is. Like, and I understand he's put on 3 stone of bulk and not all of it is muscle. But like, Rory has not made a secret of getting up very early in the morning to change his gym routine and become an extremely fit, agile athlete.
Like, yeah, but Rory is 5 foot. Rory's 5 foot 8. But DeChambeau is six foot one.
I know, but his swing speed is still unbelievable. Like, I think Rory can get out of rough as well all day long.
That's the other thing I was wondering. We spoke about it last week. All the caddies are throwing the ball down. It didn't feel like players were struggling to get it out of the rough. Like, there wasn't too many. Like, there's no short videos of McIlroy or Justin Thomas where, you know, they hit it 2 yards and they're throwing their hands in the air and all that sort of stuff. Like, there wasn't that. So, was the power the key?
I mean, well, Peter said it earlier on. I mean, power, but power has to be the key. It's not the only key, but it has to be the main differential. I mean, you could say, DeChambeau, was he lucky? Did he land a great lie every time he went into the rough? I mean, that's a lot of rough you're hitting to get really good lies. And sure, he did get lies, but did he get better lies than everybody else?
No, that's fair. I guess by his logic, he's able to get a wedge or a nine iron to the ball, and Earl Brendan Todd, who is trying to lay up or get as far as he can down there, can't find the fairway every time. So, I mean, 4, 5, 6 iron out of that rough compared to a wedge is a different ball game. So, you know, that's, and that was DeChambeau's logic on Wednesday. Like, if I bomb it down there, it doesn't really matter if I'm in the rough, I can get to the front of the green and you could run it up to those greens.
But my argument is not about poor Brendan Todd. I'm not poor Brendan Todd, but Brendan Todd or the shorter hitters, the Webb Simpsons. My argument is really positing, what does Bryson DeChambeau have at the moment that Ram doesn't have, DJ doesn't have, Justin Thomas doesn't have, Rory McIlroy doesn't have, all guys who can go toe-to-toe with Bryson DeChambeau on straight length. Like, there might be, you know, 10 yards in the difference, but not much.
But like he was also just red hot this week. I think the answer this week, if you look at his strokes gained, where he's ahead of the field in every single category and considerably so, I think he just had a red hot week and he had a brilliant strategy. Like, DJ's putting his 2 iron in the bag and he's afraid to draw the ball and he, you know, makes a mess of the whole thing and just, you know, blows up and it's goodbye. I just think DeChambeau had a red hot week across the field. I mean, if you were to say to me now, is he going to win 5 majors? I would say probably not.
Well, so before moving on, I just wanted to emphasize that you are absolutely correct. When you watch, say, Reed's collapse or what happened to Matt Wolf. Now, in fairness to Matt Wolf, he's 21. He's playing in the last group of on a Sunday. And, you know, the pressure is just enormous. And he'll be fine in time. But you're right. DeChambeau played brilliantly. He missed on the right side. His up and downs were phenomenal. His putting was exceptional. His overall read of the game, everything he did was brilliant. So you can put it down to he had a really hot week. He started on Thursday full of confidence, and that confidence brought him right through to the closing hole on Sunday. But there's more. There has to be more. It can't just be that it was just his week to shine. He overpowered a course that destroyed every other player. And there have to be reasons for that, that are not necessarily just to do with, like, he's on a good streak. And I'd be curious what Peter has to...
John, to be honest with you, can I come in there? I firmly believe, and looking at them, and okay, we're only looking from the outside in, okay? But his whole attitude is 1,000,000% golf. Everything around his game, he is doing 110%. Porrick Harrington did it at the start of his career. He won 3 majors. Everything was golf. He slept, he drank, he did everything golf. There was nothing else. There was nothing else mattered. His body conditioning, his mental, his everything, even down to having Porrick used to have U and V-shaped grooves or box grooves in his irons so he could play out of the rough, get flyers out of the rough or not get flyers out of the rough. That's where he was down to. And I think Bryson is the same. Yes, he hit it in the rough like everybody else. Yes, he's a little bit stronger than everybody else coming out of the rough, but his read of the ball coming out of the rough was better than anybody else's. He didn't make the huge mistakes of going massively long or massively short. He read the lie better than anybody.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a golfer out there at this moment in time that is putting as much into the game, into his game, as Bryson DeChambeau, and hence he won. And I think if everybody else was to sit back and look at themselves and look in the mirror going, does golf mean that much to me? They'll have to come up with the thing of it actually doesn't, because I'm not putting the same effort in. You know, effort equals results. And I think that is where Bryson is at this moment in time.
But can we say that about a field? Can we say that with confidence that Bryson is working harder than anybody else? I mean,
I'm
not suggesting for a second he isn't.
No, but I said at the very start, looking from the outside in,
yeah,
it certainly, and I don't know this, so it's only an opinion, yeah, but outside in, I definitely think he is putting more into his golf game than anybody else's.
It also, obviously, going back to the mental side again, gives him brilliant clarity of thought. Like, you're talking about Dustin Johnson and a 2-iron and what should I do? So many of those players are turning up for the toughest test in golf, trying to plot a way around the course. Whereas actually, he was so self-confident. He's like, actually, I know what I want to do. I know exactly what I'm going to do here. I'm not going to change my game. I've worked on this game for the last 6 months. I've worked on this body. I've worked on this shot. I'm just going to go and I'm going to rock up with it. And yeah, it may have fallen flat in its face. And we may have spent 30 seconds talking about Bryson DeChambeau going, maybe he'll scale things back rather than, as it looks as though he's going to do for Augusta, scale it up another notch again. But actually, he was so sure of what he wanted that he was going in, probably as well because of the work, with more confidence than anybody else. So yeah, there's questions. And I think, like, Harrington's been his best mate over the last couple of months, in that Harrington has been able to explain in a very legitimate sounding way that this was always there for Bryson DeChambeau. It's whether now, like, we've seen signs of Tony Finau, who you've touched on, and Harrington's touched on, who can get similar ball speed, whether he goes all out, because there was still a sense during the coverage the last day that, you know, Finau's, you know, he's up in it, but he's still only probably at 80-85%. Does he now look at this and think,
yeah,
geez, you know, I've won a lot of money, but I still haven't won tournaments. Yeah. Do I just need to go all out? And does, like, and I think it's too late in one sense for, like, if you are to change equipment, ball, all of that, are you opening yourself to all sorts of legal challenges? Because again, Harrington, we go back to this a lot, 4 or 5 years ago when we're talking about McIlroy and needing to win his majors quickly,
yeah,
spoke about this conveyor belt of talent that's coming through the US college system who do exactly what McIlroy does, but do it longer, better, more consistently. So win your majors quickly because these guys are coming and they're here. And Bryson DeChambeau is 27. Matthew Wolff is only 21. They can do the exact same thing.
Yeah. And on his clarity of thought, and Peter, you talked about the way he's reading the rough. At one point, I don't know which day it was or which shot, but he was doing his calculations with his caddy. It was great how, you know, they're all so mic'd up now. And, you know, he's going through the various checkpoints of what's going to dictate his yardage. And then he was like, and looking at this rough, this is a 10% rough, you know, as in 10% yardage. And I was like, I'm kind of thinking, maybe he's deluding himself that, you know, you trick yourself into believing you know all this, and how can you tell the percentage of the rough? But there was a clarity about his play at Camness. So a quick kind of wrap up point, because I do want to hit McIlroy before Nathan has to go. He's got to shoot early today. How do you bring a Brendan Todd? I'm using him because he hit all the fairways, basically, and he's shorter. Is it fair, Peter, so you're a golfer, Nicklaus hit the ball a long way, Woods bombed it a long way, and you have to remember, bar DeChambeau, nobody was under par. Like, Wingfoot, 16 years on or 14 years on, stood up okay, you'd have to say. And they made it piss easy on the first day. So actually, they could have had close to a Jeff Ogilvy, you know, kind of territory if they wanted. So I thought, you separate, you know, DeChambeau for a moment. Wingfoot stood up okay in the debate about length. Like, it kind of, that's a decent innings, 14 years on. To bring a Brendan Todd into it. So again, yeah, Woods hit it long, Nicklaus hit it long. You still want to reward length. Could you see a point where the US Open, you have the rough crazy deep from 315 yards on, and actually at 270 to 280 territory where a McDowell and a Todd is, you effectively mow the rough down. Is that fair? Is that a good idea?
Not fair and not a good idea.
Grant, I was wondering that.
Yeah, no. Look, all sports move on. And athletes get better and better and better at doing what they do. This thing of, and I listened to your interview with Paul McGinley, and you know, I'd had to say, you know, as a career that Paul McGinley had, and could he have the same career now? He admits to it, he'd probably struggle now. So Brendan Todd is in the same boat. Unfortunately, golf has moved on. It's on a couple of generations now. And
but is the emphasis wrong? Is the point? Like, is there too much emphasis on length?
But if they bring back the ball, okay, Brendan Todd is going to hit it shorter, and the longer hitters are still going to hit us that 20% further than him.
Yeah, maybe. But McGinley was talking about the trampoline effect with the modern day clubs, where you get an exponential amount when you get over a certain threshold.
You do. They've dialed that back as well. But they'll just get bigger and stronger and hit the ball further.
Okay.
You know,
there's no avoiding it.
Golf as we know it has changed, and we need to get on with it. Now, do we need to change the golf courses and go, you know, you take out the driver out of the bag and then move on from there? But they're not going to do that.
Mm-hmm. Where the money is.
But that's what we have to do. We can't keep on having golf courses at 8,000 yards long. It won't work. And golf then becomes very boring because it takes too long.
I've got to go, lads, and I'll leave you to continue this. Just one point before I do go, because the Irish Open's happening this week. And you mentioned there that Peter Lawrie is a golfer. And while it's brilliant to have you here every Thursday, Peter, I do wonder why you're sitting here chatting to us while 49-year-old Damian McGrain is just rocking along, tied for 12th. I thought you were tired together, yet somehow he's back playing on the European Tour, competing in contention at an Irish Open. What are you doing?
Okay, well, let's put it this way. I retired. Damien still plays the Irish PGA circuit, and he played in the playoffs the end of last year. And normally that would not qualify for you for the Irish Open. But this year, they didn't have a normal qualifying that they did for the last couple of years. And hence, they had to take two national spots. And those national spots were taken up by that qualifying, that tournament that he played in. But I'm delighted for Damien. He's got his son on the bag, I believe.
Great.
So it's a family affair. So well done.
Jeez, if McGrain wins, that could make this an unbelievable Irish Open. You know, modest field, but that'd be unbelievable.
Well, I have to admit, Nathan, I struggle with the Irish Open this week. I really do.
You go with your rant. I've got to go. You go with your rant.
Okay. I'm going to rant while you leave.
I disagree
you
with everything
disagree
you said.
Because you haven't heard it yet.
Good luck, lads.
See you. Nathan Murphy got to shoot off early today. So one last point on the Shamba, by the way. Given how badly you got this wrong, Peter, you know, how atrociously wrong.
Hold on. Can I just ask you a question before we start, right?
Yeah.
On Saturday morning,
yeah.
What were you thinking?
Can't remember.
No, you don't lie to me now, Joe. What were you thinking?
Sorry.
That Larry, F-U-C-K-E-R, was probably going Patrick Reed.
Incorrect. Incorrect. And I can prove this. I can prove this. I bumped into no lesser man than Malachy Clerkin in St. Dan's Park, and we both said DeChambeau.
Wow.
And not only that, we were like, he's going to run away with it. So there's proof there.
Did you run down to the bookies that's close to St. Anne's Park and put your tenner on Bryson? No.
I didn't even check the odds. I didn't look. But okay. we both were of a mind that Bryson is going to run away with this thing. So given how badly wrong you got this, I'm obviously, you know, kidding. Yeah. But and you're right to say most people thought this is not sustainable length. This, you know, when he gets onto a proper test, proper major course, this isn't going to work for him. Do you now have to reevaluate everything, including squally showers at a British Open? Like, all bets are off now. He's proven he can do this. Or do you still think this is a bit of, you know, lightning in a bottle?
That's I'm screwed if I say yes, and I'm screwed if I say no, because nobody thought that you could swing it at this speed and be consistent. Now, he's not that consistent, but his ability, as we spoke about, getting it out of the rough and getting it, you know, out of the positions that he was in with the driver, has improved tremendously. Has he scaled it back a little bit from when he started out? I think fractionally he has.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, to get that little bit more consistency. I really don't think swinging the club at 200 miles an hour will get you the consistent. It'll certainly get you distance, but you will hit it on your off day, absolutely off the planet. But fortunately enough for Bryson, he has kept it on the planet and has kept that club face square.
And is planning to put on another 10 pounds of bulk by Augusta and play with a 48-inch driver.
Yeah. And have a guess. I have to hold up my hand. Who has a new long driver? I got John Dignam to build me one the other day to give it a try.
Did you?
So, yeah. So I wonder how many people would be coming in now with going longer drivers and giving it a go.
I think Justin Rose was using one at the Payne Valley thing with Woods and JT and Rory, because him and Tiger were in a conversation and Tiger was asking him about it and how it changes his swing and do you do this and do you do that with it. So I think Rose has gone for a longer driver. Nathan Murphy, are you back in the game here?
I'm back in the game. I had promised my children last week they had a big swimming thing on that I would definitely go to it. And as I walked out and said, come on, let's go, my wife pointed out that the swimming pools are closed.
Is this thing called COVID-19?
Yeah, there's a global pandemic affecting
and,
the whole world.
And communication as well.
Fionn,
can I just add one thing about length?
Yes, go on, yeah.
Okay, so this, and Brendan Todd, I realize, is this week's example of the shorter hitter. And he, because he hit all the fairways. But here's the thing. The march of human progress is such that, like, runners go faster, golfers go longer. That's just the way it goes. Like, I'm sorry, Brendan, but like, if you can't hit the ball a long, long way, you're never really going to compete at the very top level. You don't have to be tall. Rory McIlroy proves that. But let's take, like, look at tennis, right? Like, John McEnroe, perhaps, you know, well, he was 5'11". In the top 10 in tennis, there's only two players, Kei Nishikori and David Goffin, who are under 6 feet tall. You want to play tennis at the very top level, you have to be massive because that serve angle has to be high enough that you can get, like, put serious speed. But, like, nobody's rolling back and going, no, but we want to help the 5'7" tennis players. Like, that's just the way it goes.
You were having that debate last night, Joe, as well, on around cycling, which maybe isn't the best thing to be bringing up around the Tour de France, as to what is an acceptable level of improvement from 20, 25 years ago, from Greg LeMond, from Miguel Indurain. Like, what is, because you would expect that cyclists, like every other sport, should be getting stronger. I guess the question, and McGinley, listening to him that the other night, so on one hand you go, well, the Paul McGinley, if he was coming through now, wouldn't be playing the game the way he learned the game, because there'd be no point, because you would be fully aware that, as you say, I need to be able to hit the ball long. So are we going to lose that type of player, or actually are they all just going to become one of the same? And you're probably seeing it, Peter, I don't know, at the range of 16, 17 year old kids coming in, like, maybe the range is more popular than ever because they're not spending any time on the short game. All they want to do is spend as much time on the range and bomb it as far as possible, regardless of what height they are, what weight they are. And, like, you do well to dissuade them from going down that route.
Every young lad that comes into the range with the top tracer technology that we have wants to now not go downstairs to hit balls. They want to go upstairs. They want to go and every shot to be tracked. And they have no interest in nearest the flag or playing golf courses. They just want to go out there and bomb it and see how far each one of them can hit it further than the other. And that's what they see on TV, and that's what it's about. And it all happens in different sizes. Like, if you look back even further back than Paul McGinley is, Ian Woosnam. Ian Woosnam came out and he was able to fly it over the bunker on the left-hand side of Augusta on the 18th when nobody could get, Sandy Lyle was hitting it into it. And he won the Masters that way. He was exceptionally long for his size, but he wouldn't be able to play out of the rough as well as these guys would be, because his angle of attack is too shallow.
Yeah. They might just have to think up of a new defense. I don't know. I mean, I guess the issue, like, with tennis, is there a shot in tennis which is now almost extinct? Like, you still see finesse and you still see baseline rallies and you still see serve and volley and you still see a drop shot or a lob. Like, pretty soon we're not going to see five irons.
No.
Yeah.
Well, it's what you put the video up on Twitter about a month, 6 weeks ago, and we're making the point that, like, is there a better sight in golf than McIlroy with a wood in his hand, you know, 220 yards? Like, that shot is going.
Yeah, because they were hitting at winged foot, they were hitting, I think, 8 irons into the par five as their second.
Yeah.
So that's when it's crap. Like, you know, that's okay, it's fine because I'd love watching the shot. It doesn't really matter. And could I tell a 5 iron from a 9 iron from, you know, at first glance when they're standing over striking the ball? No, but like that, if you're making that middle section of the game extinct, then I guess it gets a bit grim. Mm. I don't know. The debate, the distance debate's pretty boring a lot of the time, isn't it? And Fionn, you looked at the ratings. So did Bryson capture the imagination?
No. Sunday's final round, 1.99 overnight rating, which is on a par with some of the better return to golf events. So the events that have led up to this, but easily a record low for a US Open.
Record low.
A record low. There are, however, there is an important caveat.
Football.
American football. In a normal year, the US Open isn't up against, you know, the Dallas Cowboys against the Atlanta Falcons. This year, because of the timing, it was. And it suffered horrendously as a result. But there's no getting away from it that once you put the big sports up against, golf is irrelevant.
Fair enough.
I think Bryson probably suffered a bit because of that as well, and the dullness of the back nine and how straightforward. As we've spoken about it a lot, golf has been brilliant since the return because there's been so much drama. There have been so many wonderful finishes. But at a major, like, that's what you want.
Yeah.
You want St. Andrews 2015. You want collapses. You want four or five players in contention. Like, a stroll through the park are always the most forgettable majors, unless it's McIlroy bursting through this young gun who may dominate the game. Bryson, there's too much time for everybody to start questioning him over the final sort of 90 minutes.
You know, it's pretty
snazzy. What do you think of the galleries not being there, even at a major?
I miss it at majors.
Yeah?
They said one of the things, I can't remember, was it Nick Doherty and Andrew Coulthard, who, for my money, are the best pundit pairing. I love them. Absolutely adored them. I thought they were brilliant. But one of them or other made the point that had the galleries been there, particularly a New York crowd at a US Open, that the that maybe Bryson wouldn't have had an easy ride of it from a lot of fans, and that they would have done their level best to break his concentration. That in the true time-tested fashion of a rowdy US Open crowd. And obviously then there's the trampling of the rough and all the rest of it, but that maybe DeChambeau wouldn't have had as quiet a time of it as he did.
Maybe, yeah. Nathan, Rory.
It was okay. Give himself a chance. Obviously the double bogey to start on Sunday.
Yeah.
Yeah, like that was the end of it. And in hindsight, like, maybe his name on the leaderboard puts a bit more pressure on DeChambeau. Like, nobody was going to go particularly low. Like, he needed to get that to 2 under probably to give himself any sort of a chance and ask a few questions. I think he played good golf over the week, got himself there, obviously started really well. That's the frustration, that he didn't capitalize on the Thursday. I seem to have got that out of my system at least. But yeah, I think you could probably put 10 other golfers in sort of Rory's circle, Justin Thomas as well, give himself a chance and just struggle. And again, mentally, I guess when it starts going against you, like, it's impossible for the head not to drop.
His post-round comments were interesting. I don't really know what to say, because that's just the complete opposite of what you think a US Open champion does. Look, he's found a way to do it. It's not the way I saw this golf course being played or this tournament being played. It's kind of hard to really wrap my head around it. Whether that's good or bad, it's just the way it is. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. Well, if he thought he was right, he would say so. So he does think it's kind of wrong. But like, it suggests that the way he approached the course, that he recognized very quickly based on watching what happened, that he got it completely wrong. Despite the fact, as Nathan said, he played quite well. He didn't play any worse than anybody else except for Bryson DeChambeau and maybe Matt Wolf. But yeah, I mean, it was a perfectly creditable performance. It just wasn't Rory McIlroy, the scariest golfer in the world that everybody's afraid of, because, yeah, you know, that's just, it doesn't seem to be the case and hasn't been maybe for a while.
Yeah, he was 3 under on the Thursday. The two toughest days, 76 on the Friday, 75 on the Sunday, really cost him. Like the 76 on Friday was particularly costly. Paul McGinley made the point, Peter, on commentary and then with us during the week, that he's got to find a way to get it around on the tough days.
Find a way to shoot level par, if not, you know, very close to it. And that's what all the top guys do. You know, the real top players who are in there, we go back, you have to use Tiger as an example. Even on his off days, he can shoot level par or at worst one over and doesn't kick him out of the tournament. With shooting six over and five over on Friday and Sunday, you're out of the tournament.
Mm.
So he needs to look at that. And but like with anything else, as I've seen, it's so frustrating when you support Rory and you know how good he can be. And he shoots the scores on the Thursday and you think, right, he's really in it. Yeah. You know, maybe we were wrong to not sort of say that he would do well this week. And then Friday comes and you say, well, that's the reason. And there's a long way back mentally for that. And he gets back into it. But then Sunday he goes out. Where's his course strategy? I heard Paul talk about this on
first hole.
With yourself on his first hole. Like where's the strategy? Where's the knowledge that you've sought from somebody else or you've watched it on TV that you got to be attacking this flag? So that's just the question.
Do you remember a couple of years ago at an Irish Open, Jay Townend criticized his strategy and got like major rebuke back?
Yeah.
Do you have associated strategy with McIlroy's game?
No, I suppose no. Jay Townsend got serious abuse from Rory hitting driver off the 18th, and JP letting him hit driver off the 18th. I think was the thing. Like he was saying there was nowhere to hit it.
Right.
I disagreed with Jay Townsend then.
Okay.
But I don't disagree with him now. You know, if he comes out and says, you know, where's your strategy? Because you have to have a strategy around one of the toughest golf courses you're going to play all year.
Tiger, just to briefly mention it, I mean, it seems silly to even mention it. He did putt much better, by the way. And I was telling you all that he was playing sneakily good for a long time. I'd now like to retract.
I felt so much pressure suggesting that I thought he would miss the cut. And then on the Friday, I found myself in this weird position of like kind of going, oh my God, come on, Tiger. But like,
he was 1 under at one point, but yeah.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah.
Over. We'll talk about
he's
it.
Saving ahead. Himself for Pain Masters. Valley.
Yeah. The Masters, yeah. I mean, he's showing no form. I don't know. I just
there's a couple of months. There's a long way to go, and it's a weird scenario going there in November. Is the course going to be an entirely different beast in November compared to March? What's Bryson's strategy going to be? Are people going to follow him? And like, some are already following. Like, Phil followed him last week. Phil just tried to drop bombs all day Thursday and Friday. Unfortunately, it didn't go quite as well for Phil.
Oh my God, it was a disgrace, Phil Mickelson.
His driving on Thursday was every shot. The shot tracer was like, oh my God.
What did Phil end up on? Like plus 16 or something, was it?
It was 45. I don't know. It was just insane. Like it was like a rank amateur driving.
But I mean, last week we all confidently predicted that the course didn't suit Bryson DeChambeau. And we all saw what happened. But I'm going to predict 50 odd days out from the Masters. It's not that the Augusta doesn't suit Bryson DeChambeau. It suits way too many other players. And I think I can't see DeChambeau having the same dominant performance at Augusta that he did last week. Just no way. There are too many other players who play that. Look, if Tiger Woods can win at Augusta in 2019, there's loads of players can win at Augusta.
Well, it's what he does on those dog legs that Like, was it, listening to a few podcasts during the week, it might have been Rex Hoggard, the podcast he's on, that one of the things that we're commenting on from being there was how much higher Deschambault was hitting the ball than Matthew Wolf, that he was able to go well over any trees, where there might have been a little bit of a risk at times for Wolf the way he was hitting it, that actually Deschambault has the distance and the height that he doesn't need to worry about it. So again, does that have him hitting in a slightly different part of the golf course? Like, that'll be the conversation of, well, we've never seen anyone hitting the approach from here before.
Yeah.
But Peter, and so isn't it the case, Peter, that the par fives at Augusta are, relative to other par fives in the PGA Tour, are actually quite short? It's just that they're, the way they're structured, you have to move the ball around trees. So, but like, you know, there's a lot of players can go over those. Rory McIlroy can go over those trees on, what is it, 13?
13.
Yeah. Mm. So he can way over those trees. And so he leaves himself with, like, you know, 9 iron or whatever it is. But isn't that like one of the, that ultimately these are not particularly threatening par fives, which is why so many people birdie them.
They're not threatening par fives. And Augusta's, I think, no longer threatening. And hence Tiger Woods can win around it, because he doesn't have to be that exceptionally long. Augusta's all about local knowledge, I would have thought, about where to place your ball to give yourself the best opportunity. But I disagree with you a little bit, because Bryson could go to Augusta and pretty much he'll get close to a couple of par fours, and he'll totally disrespect the par fives. He can hit 9 iron into at least two of them. So it's all about, for him, about, you know, his putting, and his putting has been sensational. And his short game has been sensational.
Yeah.
Like, let's just take, for example, the chip shot that he hit on 18. Now, I know he was going to win the tournament, but he still took it on and he still hit a decent shot, and he got it up and down when other people, Tiger took 6 from there on the Friday. So I wouldn't count him out. And I know, like, yeah, people are going to say, oh, Laurie's talking shite again because, you know, he discounted him at the US Open. But when you look how good his short game can be, you know, you have to take it.
Do you think a lot of young players will start looking for fat grips on their irons?
I hope not, because they really, really have to have the bulk to use them. If they bulk up, yes, but not just yet, because for young people, they need a bit of they need their wrists to be in the game to hit it that little bit longer.
And sorry, I'm going to ask all three of you this question. Like, one of the things, and I've been thinking about it, why I'm so reluctant to concede brilliance to Deschambault, other than he doesn't come across as particularly, not an unlikable, he's not particularly likable, but then again, neither was Tiger, is the aesthetics of it. I mean, he's amazing, but he's just, aesthetically, I just have, that straight-armed everything is just, it's horrible. It's
the putting is the one that puts you
it's
off.
It's the worst. And is that just like, is that just me being kind of, no, aesthetics has to matter. How someone does something has to matter. Like, yeah, in how you feel about it.
I've come to like it.
Do you?
At first I thought it was like AI playing golf and, you know, terrible. But now
Joel's now doing it.
I actually have. I've started doing it.
But this is where the, as I said at the start, the USGA and the RNA, they're awfully slow in making making rules and changing things. And when they do get the opportunity to change things, they really made a huge mistake. They had the opportunity to say the shortest club in your bag has to be the putter. And therefore you'd get none of this arm holding or anchoring, or, because that's what a lot of people are saying about Bryson. He anchors the putter against his forearm, which is probably bigger than my calf. And it's a whole lot easier to anchor it when something is that solid beside it. So, you know, they're going to be slow again in relation to the ball or doing something about it. They've had this report for 2 years now, the correlating data about how far the ball is going, and still they've done nothing about it. Nicklaus has been banging on about this for the last 10 years and they've done nothing about it. So,
golf is that what struggling. Rory's point? Because just to go back to that quote that I read out earlier on, Rory said, look again, whether that's good or bad, that's just the way it is. With the way he approaches it, with the arm lock putting, with everything, it's just where the game's at right now. And isn't that just code for where the game is at because the governing bodies are moving at glacial pace to do anything? And the frustration that maybe people like Rory McIlroy and many others besides might feel, you know, about addressing issues like arm lock putting or having the putter kind of anchored up against basically your bicep.
Because it's that much of an advantage. Don't do it.
Yeah.
If Rory feels that he has some sort of an advantage and it's not illegal, go and do it.
Yeah.
But that's what they did do, Nathan. Eventually, we're going to see everybody do it. They did it with the long putter. They did it with the belly putter. And eventually, in college golf, there was a year in college golf that the only way to putt thought by the college was belly putter. You weren't allowed to use any other putter because this was the method that was the best. And the RNA came along and got rid of it. But, or the USGA, the RNA. Going back to the very start of the conversation of this pod about the organizational bodies doing something about golf and worrying about lawsuits and players having such an advantage. It really bothers me, these statements, because like many other organizations, there has to be a point where people say enough is enough and we have to make a decision. And the decision is this, and we're going to stand by it. We're actually going to die by it, and not have the big corporations, the likes of Titleist, Callaway, and whoever else, bring them to court. Just they're going to have to stand up and change things. I used to harp on about Paul McGinley, about the European Tour having to stand up and change things in relation to field sizes and fields, about getting any kind of decent players to play in tournaments. Irish Open this week, there's four guys in the top 100. Now, I know it's COVID times, and let's just park that one. But the Dubai Duty Free came as a $7 million tournament, and they struggled to get fields. Wentworth, they struggled to get fields. There's a time in any business, in any corporation, where you just have to stand up and say no. Now we might have to take 10 feet back and you know, muddle through for the first couple of years, but eventually you're going to change things for the better. The player has to stop being the one that's, you know, as they say, it's the tail wagging the dog, and that is what is happening, and that is what needs to be changed in golf.
But hasn't it always been that way, at least since the professional era, since the big three, since Mark McCormack and Arnie Palmer and Jack Nicklaus and Gary Player, that beforehand, yeah, it was an entirely different game. But once Arnie Palmer kind of creates modern golf of a fashion, that the player was the dominant one. I mean, we talked about it on the pod, I don't know, last year, a couple of years ago, or when we were talking about the threat of the PGL, that in whatever it was, 1970-71, that the players absolutely, including Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer, threatened a breakaway unless the money was divvied up to be more favourable towards the players. It's ever been thus. And
it was IMG who took over the tour.
Sorry, IMG.
Which is Mark McCormack. It's the same. Mark McCormack built IMG. It was, you know... And it wasn't the players. It was actually the management companies who looked after Arnold Palmer, who looked after Jack Nicklaus. And it was, they were pushing Arnold Palmer to go, you say this because this is going to fill your pockets. It actually wasn't, in my view, the actual player saying it. It was the management company behind it saying, we can get you X amount of money if you say this. I suppose Rory was asked this question a long time ago, you know, does he feel a duty of care to golf? And his response was, I'm only really cared about what I do. It's, you know, but he's wrong. When you're in a sport and the sport has to continuously grow and get people into the sport, you have a duty of care if you are the number one. Let's take Michael Jordan, for example, as the best basketball player ever to live, supposedly. He had a duty of care, but unfortunately, he let that slip a little bit when he had this opportunity to I think we spoke about it, making Black Lives Matter, and you know, he missed his opportunity when he was at the top of his game. And I think the rest of the players have to realize that they have to look at the organization now and say, right, well, where are we going to go in the next couple of years? And how good is this going to be in the next couple of years? Or are we going to destroy it now? And, you know, forever, we'll take the money and run. But in 10 years' time, golf will never be what it is.
But okay, so but with all respect, say, to a Jack Nicklaus, when Jack Nicklaus was at the height of his career, he wasn't a great advocate for big rule changes, or, you know, he wasn't the kind of the watchman looking over his beloved sport the way he has been for the last 30 years, say. You know, that what I mean is that a professional athlete, his primary obligation is to his or her own career, establishing their own legacy, if they're in a position to do so. And then once that personal legacy established, then if they have that mind, if they have that breadth of imagination, if they have that sense of, as you say, duty of care, and I don't disagree with anything you're saying, but that's only once that's done can they then start address the broader issues around the sport. So all of a sudden, what we're looking to is not Rory McIlroy. What we're looking to is Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, you know, players of that ilk who's best perhaps is definitely behind them. And so they can say, okay, guys, look, let's take care of this sport of ours.
But Jack Nicklaus did it with the Ryder Cup. He was the one who pulled them all together and say, right, we're hammering you because you're GB and I. Why don't you make it Europe? And all of a sudden, the European Tour made huge strides. And Jack Nicklaus was at his height of his career then when he was saying, you know, we really need to change this. So he was thinking...
Maybe Jack Nicklaus is a bad example
yeah,
to use.
I know, but I'm just saying he really did. And Arnold Palmer and the rest of them, you know, they all gave something back, far more than our what I see is our day-to-day players now, or our superstars now.
Some final thoughts. Payne Valley during the week looked insane. If you didn't see that, that's worth looking back. Tiger Woods' first design on American soil looked insane, named after Payne's shirt. Gary Player was on with Jack Nicklaus. They hit some shots into the 19th. There was an actual 19th hole, which is kind of a cool thing. Gary Player did that brilliant thing, which is an American broadcasters in particular sees up, where they asked him a genial enough question and he went on a phenomenal rant, which included how his brother had fought in the war for America and then he became a tree hugger. and then he talked about they're cutting down trees and all the golf courses. And look, listen, climate change, I'm with you. This was happening though as the camera was zooming out and you were looking overhead at this golf course carved into a terrain which was predominantly of trees, and they clearly cut a lot of trees to make the golf course. And Gary was also talking about how he's flown more miles than any man, you know, so it was just great.
Climate change.
But then, Jack kind of just jumped back in and got things back on track. But it was...
That's the ultimate interview, the honest Jack Nicklaus interview talking about Gary Player. Because they both show up, so they know there's money in it for both of them. So they get along because they're a nice little package. They both arrive in, they're both happy. Whereas actually, Nicklaus is sitting there going, oh my God, this guy. Yeah.
I will say in his defense, and he did this round to Chambers Bay a couple of years ago. I remember me and Fionn did a little golfing trip to Morocco a couple of years back, and you know, beautiful place and everything. But you're looking at this arid landscape and then these golf courses, and you know, not climate friendly to say the least. There is a legitimate point in there. It's just Gary picked his moment to, you know, poor old Paul Azinger was on CoCom and he was like, what? You know, I can handle Rory saying he likes dominoes, but I got nothing to say, you know, I don't know this. And then very finally, Irish Open, Dubai Duty Free Irish Open. We should give them their mention because they're keeping the show on the road at Galgorm Castle. It's underway. You know, Lowry's there. James Sugrue thinks had a decent first round.
Yeah.
Lowry's struggling. Harrington is there wearing some shades. They're not quite Phil Mickelson aviators, but he's got the shades on. Galgorm, by all accounts, I think Ryan Fox won here in the Challenge Tour with a 19 under. So it's definitely quite gettable. I don't know. What do you say? They've done very well to get the thing on. It's obviously a modest field. You're not going to have a John Rahm coming back for obvious reasons. But it's something, that's for sure.
It's good to see James Sugrue. He's two off the lead. Just before Peter comes in, I'll just go with some positivity around this week. You know, James Sugrue didn't even have an invite. And fair play to Lee Westwood. Fair play to Lee Westwood. Lee Westwood played alongside Sugrue, Bubba Watson on Thursday and Friday.
Yeah.
And obviously after his round, somebody must have said to Westwood, oh, how'd you get on with, you know, the amateur? And was like, yeah, good guy. Just tell me though, he's not in the Irish Open field next week. Seems a little bit insane that the amateur champion can get into a US Open, but he can't get into his home Open. And maybe they should give him an invite. And sure enough, an invite appeared a couple of days later for James Sugrue.
How was he not invited? Oh my God.
I don't know. But yeah, very disappointing, obviously, for Shane Lowry. 5 over 75. What is he? 107th at the moment. I get the feeling from listening to him yesterday. I think he said he's taking 5-6 weeks off. Yeah. He just wants to get back home to Dublin, feed up, forget about golf for a couple of months. And the last thing I'll say, we'll probably come back to this, and we might hopefully speak to Lowry over the next few weeks. It'll be very interesting to see what he does next year, because he'd set himself up so brilliantly winning the Open that he could do this sort of worldwide tour, and he could base himself back in Dublin and pick and choose his events at the PGA Tour. Circumstances mean he ends up spending the last 8 months in America. You could tell he wasn't happy for the last 5-6 weeks, particularly since the family went home. But all the money is in America now for 2021.
Yeah. Yeah.
So do you have to go and base yourself there again if you want to progress, even though it really doesn't seem to suit him spending that much time away from home, which is really unfortunate for him.
Yeah. Peter, any Irish Open thoughts you want to share with us?
I spoke to you about this before we came on. And look, this is my feeling, right? This is my opinion. And don't get me wrong, I have retired. 2016, I finished up. So I'm not bitter about not playing in the Irish Open one bit. I'm not a great lover of the Irish Open being played in Northern Ireland. And it's got nothing to do with North and South borders, or nothing to do with Chucky Arlaw or anything like that. A lot of the listeners mightn't realize this, but each player that plays in the Irish Open, when it is in the Republic of Ireland, does not pay withholding tax. So they get their prize money and away they go. In Northern Ireland, the prize money is subject to withholding tax, and that withholding tax goes to the English, the Queen's
Exchequer.
Let's put it that way, the Exchequer. So is it really an Irish Open then when some of your winnings, or whatever your 20% of your winnings goes to a different government and not the Irish government?
Though that if it's played in the Republic, they don't pay withholding tax?
No, there's no withholding tax in Ireland. Look, this is, I know it's a golf podcast, but let's talk about the things of a tournament coming to Ireland. It also doesn't count as you know days in the country. So if anybody is, let's say, a non-resident in Ireland, playing in the Irish Open is a great thing, because you're playing your home nation, your home Open, but you're actually not in Ireland playing it as for tax reasons. So I have a big problem.
Excuse me while my heart bleeds.
I have a problem with the Irish Open, and I know the GUI is North and South, but let's have a Northern Ireland Open. And then let's have an Irish Open, if that's what it's going to be. My opinion. It's out there now. I think the last couple of years, I've kind of hinted at it, but now I've said it.
Let me ask you this, though, and well, it's a perfectly valid point of view. What's the difference, though, if it's played in the Republic, and because it's a sporting event, they're not charging withholding tax? or they're not, you're not paying withholding tax. So it's not as if the Irish Exchequer is losing money because it's played in Northern Ireland. Is it just the fact that, like, here you have the Irish Open, but whatever tax is due is being paid to the Exchequer of the United Kingdom? That's the issue you have, rather than that the Irish Exchequer is losing on some revenue.
Pretty much so, yeah. As an Irish person, you pay your taxes and you play in your home tournament, and you still pay your taxes because you pay your tax at the end of the year. As an English player coming over, or European coming over, they'd much prefer to be played in the Republic because their withholding tax is not taken off them.
Okay, right. I see what you mean. Is that not just the a kind of another part of our hands across the border relationship?
It's a complicated situation,
yeah.
Peter.
Oh, look, yeah, it is a complicated situation. I totally agree with you. And probably the Irish Open wouldn't have survived without some funding from the Northern Ireland Tourist Board.
Yeah, and I take your point saying let's just have a Northern Irish Open and an Irish Open. I think it's great we have an Irish Open. You know, the 32 county thing in golf is a lovely thing. And, you know, for Portrush and Port Stewart and all these courses, it doesn't bother me that much if they're paying a few quid to whichever exchequer. Either both exchequers are going to waste it on something stupid anyway.
I
think, Peter, you're living in a...
Exactly, yeah. But I think...
Like, an ideal world, yes, we'd have a... I'm sure the European Tour would love to have two full-on tournaments island of Ireland. But... like, they're doing well to get one on. And part of the reason for that is that the funding is split between Fáilte Ireland and the Northern Ireland Tourist Board. So they can only make that commitment every second year rather than every year, which means they can have, all going well next year, a Rolex Series event. So it suits absolutely everybody, aside maybe from the 156 players or even half that who may have to pay some tax on their winnings, to have it every second year. And you get to see the best of Royal County Down, Port Stewart. Like, people who are coming from America, they're not looking at this border when they're playing golf. They'll play Port Monarch, they'll play Roy County Down, they'll play Ballyliffin, they'll play whatever. So why not celebrate?
This podcast is going to golfers, and this podcast is not about supporting the Irish Fáilte Ireland or the Northern Ireland Tourist Board. In my opinion, it's about golf and watching a. Watching golf and telling people what we think. So
100% here. I'm all for you having your opinion, and you've lived it. So actually it's interesting that this is the sort of conversation that golfers clearly have.
Yeah. I had no idea. I wasn't aware of it.
And
you're so some man, Peter. You're some man.
But sorry, so if you say, Peter, you had turned up this week like Damien McGrain had and, you know, kept his focus on his career and at 49 is still in contention and you were there and you win first prize of 150 grand or something like that. So you were to win that 150 grand. Are you saying you pay tax, so you lose
you'd pay
grand
immediately
in tax to the Queen and then you pay another?
Queen. Yeah.
And you have to pay it again back in Ireland?
No, because it's a double taxation agreement. But they take their money. They take your money initially.
So what's the problem?
So you'd lose 20% off the top. So whatever it is, 20% of 150 is, I don't know, 28 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So you'd only get like whatever it is, 122 of the 150.
But we're not losing out on anything then, unless an professional Irish player were to win this.
Correct.
Oh, for God's sake.
No, it's a principle.
Hold on. So hang on, we're going back to 2007, when Padraig Harrington last cashed a check. Oh, for God's sake, Peter.
As you said, Joe, and this is why I brought, you didn't know this, right? So now you know it. So it's a trivial fact.
I don't know where anybody.
Well, I tell you what. Wait till my friend's WhatsApp group gets hold of this one.
I can hear it already. It's Peter's explanation of why he doesn't think that the Irish Open should be played in Northern Ireland as an audio bed with black and tans come out, like just running gently underneath it.
Die, end that. Do not put this as the headline. Peter Lawrie's taxation breakdown of the Irish Open while you're the loser.
Actually, more seriously, Peter, would that opinion be shared by many Irish golfers?
Clearly.
No comment.
No comment. Wow. Wow.
God, I really hope Damien McGrain wins now so we can ask Damien McGrain about this.
I am very comfortable getting myself into the SH1T, but I'm certainly not going to bring anybody else in with me.
Like who?
Unless it's the three of us.
Yeah.
And you're talking to McElroy's agent. Funny, you do that, no problem. Enough.
Joe, this is a good one now here, right? I next door neighbor I was talking to the other day, right? He's a solicitor.
Oh.
And he goes, I'm going to write to that Joe Molloy. And I said, why? And he goes, the amount of defamation he has done on you, I'm going to write a solicitor's letter to him.
I give you the right of reply on the air, so it's different.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, right.
Yeah, I can say you know nothing about anything, and there's no, you know, what are you going to say about it?
You know that all the news talk presenters, do all the news talk presenters still have to do a defamation course, don't they?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I think it's part of BAI, Broadcasting Authority of Ireland regulation that we do.
Yeah. Because I did one years ago. Hmm. It's an enlightening thing what you can and
100% we should send Peter on one.
Oh.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You love it.
Peter, I kid you not. Because, and I say as someone who went to one with the, like, presupposing that I'm like, oh, it's just common sense, you know. But it really, a lot of it, sure. But it's interesting when you get down into the minutiae of it, and particularly in a jurisdiction like ours, which is incredibly litigious and absolutely where the court, you know, where courts generally favor the litigant rather than the defender, you know, someone who's defending. It's a very, very interesting thing. And then it explains maybe.
Don't give an example.
I'm not giving
Did did we get any letters from Patch Greed last week?
I don't think he heard.
Yeah, but we didn't. Jeez, actually, there was one. We thought Patrick Reed, holy moly, that was some collapse. Ugh.
But he wasn't playing well. His short game was keeping him in it.
Yeah. But
he wasn't playing well. He wasn't hitting it well. His short game was outrageous the first few days. He was hanging on. That was a hang-on job.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
true. Kind of wish I just stayed out and pretended that I brought my kids swimming.
Yeah, I think you should have went swimming, Nathan. No, it would have been far better off.
Right. We're wrapping things up. Our thanks as ever, and most importantly to our sponsors, Now TV, who are, the place you can go where you want to watch the golf on a given weekend. You can watch the football, obviously, as well. They have Serie A, EFL Championships, Premier League, everything on Sky TV. Your sport and your terms. You can pick what you watch. So thanks as ever to Now TV. Peter, is Spawell still open in the current situation?
We are indeed. We are still good. Open. Going. We're busy. Yeah.
Great. So, okay. All good. Long may it continue. Peter Lawrie.
Paying a lot of tax to the Irish government.
Where are you paying your tax?
Yeah. Absolutely Irish
corporation
government.
Tax or something. He'll have some get out. Don't you worry. Mango.
The Queen is a lovely lady, Peter.
Is she?
Fionn Davenport, thank you.
Have you watched all these? Have you watched all these programs?
Turn it off. Quickly.
All right, we're done. Goodbye.
OTV Sports Golf Weekly with Now TV. Stream the Premier League, Serie A, and EFL Championships live on Now TV. Your sport on your terms.